Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Week That Really Was with John McGurk and Sarah Ryan for the week ending the 11th. Oh, actually, it's going to be ending the 12th, isn't it, of April 2024. A momentous week, Sarah, in Irish politics. We have a new leader at long last. It felt like he's been the leader in waiting for about 6 years now. So long has it been since Leo Varadkar announced his resignation. But he was finally installed this week with a very cringy announcement, very cringy, I thought, but you know, well-intentioned, don't be too mean to the woman. Heather Humphreys saying that when she saw him first, she thought he was in the school tour, and now he's Taoiseach, and aren't we all delighted? Are you delighted?
Oh God, did she say that? I must have missed that, or maybe I just blocked it out from PTSD, from cringe.
I was watching on Oireachtas television, and honest to God, it was a reminder of what a terrible, terrible job being a TD is. They sat there all day listening to this shite, basically, and had to vote about six times for something that was utterly inevitable anyway. But yeah, that's what she did say. She said, the first time I ever saw Simon Harris, I thought he was in here on a school tour, and now sure, look at him.
Oh,
it was kind of his proud mammy stuff, basically. What did you make of the day's festivities and the significance of our new and esteemed leader?
I think it's kind of like watching like a really poor movie, you know, when at the end you're like, there was a lot of time spent watching that and nothing actually really happened. Like it was a week of massive change and yet somehow no change at all.
Well, the elephant in the room we have to talk about is the fact that, you know, normally in reshuffles, an incoming Taoiseach takes his opportunity to stamp his authority all over his political party and say, I'm the boss. These are where the jobs are going. This is my vision. And instead, he kind of stamped Helen McEntee's authority all over his own forehead and said, no, I won't be moving you. Like, what was that about? It seems to me to be a bizarre decision, but maybe you can shed light on it.
I mean, I was of the opinion or of the expectation that Helen McEntee was definitely going to be moved. And I think most people were. And then I saw something the day before the reshuffle. There was an article written about how they were concerned that it would, you know, embolden the far right if they moved Helen McEntee out of, you know, that would be a win for the far right if they moved Helen McEntee out of justice. And I thought that couldn't possibly be kind of some kind of leak from them where they're laying the groundwork for keeping her there. I don't know if it was them leaking that story, but they kept her. I'm still baffled. I thought, and I think it's a reasonable thing to think that, you know, he's the youngest ever Taoiseach. There's got to be a political nose there that's gotten him to this point for sure. And the reshuffle, the initial speeches and the moves that he's making or lack thereof in the first week or two are very coming and make me really call into question whether he's the political mind I thought he was.
Well, look, I mean, I just this analysis of moving Helen McEntee would be a win for the far right. No, it wouldn't. It'd be a crushing defeat. Keeping her there is a win for the far right. I mean, if you were to move her, I mean, the far right, in inverted commas, and for those listeners concerned that I'm buying into government framing of all this, I'm using their language. I don't believe 99% of the people they call far right actually are far right at all. Far right now apparently just means kind of like anyone who sort of disagrees with the Irish Times editorial board on immigration. But like, people who are upset about the record of this government are upset largely because of two ministers. One is Roderick O'Gorman, the other is Helen McEntee. Now, in fairness to Simon Harris, it should be said he can't do anything about Roderick O'Gorman. He could constitutionally, of course, sack him, but that would mean the Green Party would walk out of government and we'd have an election. Yeah. So Simon Harris can't practically do anything about him, but he can do something with Helen McEntee, and he has chosen not to. And he is not just expressing by keeping her in office his confidence in her moving forward as a minister. He's also saying she's done a good job to date. So he's voluntarily attaching his administration to her record going back over the last 4 or 5 years. So it's just baffling, a baffling decision. And, you know, good luck to him. I mean, one thing to be said about any Taoiseach is that they have the right to pick their own team and go into battle with the squadron of troops behind them that they've personally chosen, and he's chosen. And time will tell whether he has chosen wisely. But I mean, I just think it's an astonishing decision and a real display of weakness from somebody who was trying to project, I think, strength. And you know, he just looks a bit watery and cowardly. And you know, if you read, we keep mentioning Fionnuala Sheehan on this podcast. And it's not that we're Fionnuala Sheehan fans.
We're obsessed with Fionnuala, yeah.
We love Fionnuala. But he, he wrote a couple of pieces on this, and one of the ones he wrote suggested, or you know, suggested that there were lots of considerations there, that removing Helen McEntee might have impacted Fine Gael's fundraising, because apparently Helen McEntee's husband sits on a fundraising committee inside Fine Gael and all this sort of stuff. But that reiterates the sense of kind of weakness. So yeah, bizarre. And the other big thing that happened was the, since we last spoke, was of course the Fine Gael Ardèche, which preceded this, which was supposed to be the Simon Harris show. And yet if you read the newspaper, Sarah, it was the Kate O'Connell comeback tour. What did you make of that?
Oh, Satan lives. I thought it was cringe. I thought it was a display of narcissism. I thought it was fascinating to watch how somebody can make everything about them. I thought the Leo Varadkar resigning was an end of a dark period in my life. Spare us the dramatics. You lost your seat in a democracy. Calm down. And I thought it was, you know, an unpleasant reminder of an odious, narcissistic, self-involved, incompetent, unpleasant witch.
Well, you can't be accused of kind of concealing your true feelings this week, I have to say.
Sorry.
No. That's Sarah. Sarah tells it like it is, and how she calls it like she sees it. I have to say, I would struggle to reprimand you for your views on this one. I have to say, I thought
just
the line
for people listening, I know a number of people personally, and you do too, that she has treated really poorly. I'm not going to get into the specifics of it, but I dislike that person intensely, and I think she is awful.
Which is your honest and truly held opinion, and I it is not one that I would discourage anyone from holding, based on my own personal experiences with that quarter. But I thought the particular line, that the resignation of Leo Varadkar has been the end of a dark chapter in my life. I mean, as you said, I mean, get over yourself.
Get a human grip of yourself. Some people have real problems. Like, God almighty, would you ever calm down?
I mean, it's somewhat amusing to kind of imagine the last 4 years of the former deputy wandering around Dublin with a dark cloud over her head in the shape of Leo Varadkar, kind of shaking her fist at the skies every time his name is mentioned. And then she shook her fist at the skies. She put her arm around Simon Harris and raised her fist, and of course made that picture go into the newspapers. And then of course our press corps, I mean, God love our press corps, who just love themselves a bit of Kate O'Connell. It was everywhere. It was, you know, Kate O'Connell is back. She's back, baby. That, you know, she's considering running for the party in Dublin Bay South. And I was just thinking to myself, has anyone actually asked the Fine Gael membership of Dublin Bay South how eager they are to have their former TD back? Because I'm not entirely convinced, based on conversations I've had with people in that quarter, that the welcome would be entirely warm.
But also, it's sort of like it reads, if you were an alien brought to Earth, and it was being shown to you, you would assume that Leo Varadkar had somehow kind of sacked her, or you know, like gotten rid of her. You lost your seat in an election, democratic election. You lost your seat. Like, fair enough if you want to run again, but stop acting as if you lost your seat because Leo cast you out or something. You just lost your seat. I remember it was a great day. You were photographed. It was on the front of the Times, you and your sister. Do you remember that photo? It was like a Caravaggio painting. It was like a tragedy in oil from some kind of museum, and I don't know, the Renaissance or whatever. But it was super. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. But like, crack on if you want to run again, but stop acting like you've been personally barred by Leo. And like, also, there's a new Taoiseach this week. How is this about you?
Yeah, so can I just say, in fairness, Leo Varadkar, that obviously we don't give him much praise, but I want to praise him for his response. Because when it was put to him that Kate O'Connell had said it was the end of a dark chapter in her life, he simply said, well, I wish her the best of luck with the rest of her life, which I thought was a classy response.
To be fair, like, what is he going to say to that nonsense?
But all of this kind of paints a picture, because a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, you know, and I like to acknowledge when I kind of misread a situation as well as when I kind of got something right. And I do think I misread the situation. I think I was too optimistic, because a couple of weeks ago on this podcast, I was saying that Simon Harris is the kind of politician who could surprise you in ways you wouldn't expect. He could be the kind of Taoiseach who would come in, make sweeping changes to the cabinet, reset the agenda and say, look, we are now going to suddenly focus on law and order, tackling immigration, getting a handle on crime, fixing the housing crisis. And I mean, yes, in relation to that last point, he made some promise about building 250,000 houses a year. But by and large, he's not done that. If anything, he has gone with what conventional wisdom, anti-Simon Harris wisdom, would have said he would do, which is basically charted a sort of the steady as she goes, Leo Varadkar will write about everything agenda.
Yeah, which is really, I mean, like, look, you know, it's important, John, you're only 40. It's important not to, you know, descend too much into cynicism about politics, especially given you're that you're the editor of a news outlet. But at the same time, you know, only 2 weeks later, I think it's time to probably admit defeat on that expectation.
Yes, I think it is. Can I just say, speaking of being only 40, that this is the God's honest truth. I got a phone call in the middle of the week from a relatively senior person, not an ambassador, but a relatively senior person.
Well, you're going to do this again now. I got about 20 people ask me who you were referring to in the last podcast.
We're talking about
a government person telling you that, you know, ranting to you. And I had multiple people ask me and I had to keep counsel on that one. So steady as she goes now, John.
If I started repeating the identities of these people, they would stop talking to me fairly quickly. Anyway, I want to finish the story. This person was a relatively senior person in a European Union embassy in Dublin. Who called me because he was reporting back to his foreign ministry on a biography of the new Taoiseach, because this is something that embassies do. They report back and they say, you know, this is what you need to know about him. These are the key points of his biography and so on. And this person rang me and he said, I just want to check something because somebody told me that he never finished college. And that can't be right, can it? And I said, no, it is right. And he was baffled, my interlocutor. He said, no, but how is that the case? And I said, well, you know, Simon Harris did his Leaving Cert, went to DIT in Dublin, studied French and journalism, and dropped out after a year.
And that was it, really?
And that was it, yeah. And this person was astonished. And then what was funny about that was that I repeated this conversation verbatim to somebody very close to me later on that afternoon in amusement. I said, oh, this person was shocked. And I took it for granted that everybody knew this. And the person I was talking to said, no, that can't be right. But no, it's correct. And I think people in this country just generally don't have an idea. And lest I be accused of snobbishness, I am not saying that a college degree is the be-all and end-all. But I don't think that people in this country have any idea how inexperienced this guy is compared to a lot of 37-year-olds. I mean, he never had a full-time job outside of politics. His first job was working for Francis Fitzgerald as a parliamentary assistant. He then gets elected to the county council, then gets elected to the Dáil, then becomes a minister, then becomes Taoiseach. He's never had a job outside politics. He doesn't have a third-level qualification, which is not... None of these things in itself are bad, but I'm not sure, Sarah, they're a good combination for somebody to lead the country forward. I'm sure he has lots of... In fairness, I want to say, I'm not trying to equivocate in what I'm saying either, but it's only fair to point out he does have a range of skills that not a lot of people do. He's a tremendous communicator. He's very good at people, all that sort of stuff. He has natural political talent. There's no doubt about that. But in terms of actually managing the ship of state, I'm not sure the public are aware of just how green this guy's hands are. I wonder whether that would become an issue. And I think it's something that people like Sinn Féin should be focusing on rather than Mary Lou McDonald putting out videos going, why aren't you in the Dáil today, Simon?
Honestly, I'm now more convinced than I've ever been that there's like a Fianna Fáil or a Fine Gael mole at the senior level of advisory within Sinn Féin. There's no other explanation for the level of tomfoolery and nonsense. And like literally every time two roads diverged in a yellow wood of political decision, let's take the wrong one. Every single time, there's just something wrong. How is this so poor?
I mean, it takes a lot to get me actually annoyed on Simon Harris's behalf. because as listeners may have divined, I mean, I want to say I'm not a fan, and I mean that in political terms. I've met him loads of times. He's a very nice, personable guy. Nothing to say about him personally that's bad, but I'm not a fan of him politically at all.
Yeah, no, I mean, most of the time when we're talking about politicians, it's not, listen, like 99.9% of the time, and actually only the 1% is just Kate O'Connell, when I'm actually not talking about people personally. Like, it's just a politician, except for obviously the exception when they're odious people.
But it it takes a lot for me to be annoyed on Simon Harris's behalf politically, but that did it. Mary Lou, kind of like, obviously, I mean, you know, if you want a Taoiseach who's in the Dáil 24/7 answering questions whenever you have them, then you want the country not to be governed at all. And the odious hypocrisy of it, because if she's ever a Taoiseach and somebody says, why aren't you in the Dáil? The very same people clapping her like seals for this will be saying, well, obviously she has to run the country. She can't be there all the time.
But it's also, Jesus, I would give her credit where credit is due. And I think she's a smart person and she's a good communicator. And as we said on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, like, she had a thumping general election, the last general election, and she was the best at the debates, whatever. She's saying, even if she's being advised, these words are coming out of her mouth. Like, is it possible that people can become dum-dums after being clever before?
It's starting to look that way.
Also, even worse than that, John, nobody's falling for that shite. Nobody's, like, I saw it, and then I went over to Simon Harris's Twitter or his TikTok or something, and it was a video, and it was like, oh, you know, first day as Taoiseach, here's what I did today. Like, announced the cabinet and stuff, and she's like, he's not in the Dáil to answer my questions. Like, it's base level stupid politics that people expect more from. She's not losing votes for him. She's losing votes for herself.
It's also, and this is a mistake, it's playing into his strengths. Because I wrote a piece during the week, which you know, I think the best allegory for Simon Harris is the Father Ted character, Owen McClough. people will remember Owen McClough. He did a TV show that Mrs. Doyle loved, and she wrote a poem saying, "Owen McClough is happy." Yeah, women loved it. And the whole Graham Linehan wrote this character, and the whole shtick was that Owen McClough was kind of like, he was kind of I think he was taking the piss out of Daniel O'Donnell when he wrote the character.
Yeah.
But the idea was, you know, that he's smiley and he's happy and he likes puppies and he likes cakes and you know, he's
man child. Yeah.
Yeah. Man child. And you'd love to take him home and tuck him into bed. That kind of appeal. And I'm not saying Simon Harris is exactly like that, but I saw the video you're talking about where he was sitting down there strategically, shirt, no jacket, looking into the camera, talking about all the really important meetings he had today and not really saying anything. And it came hot on the heels of a video he'd done a few days beforehand where he literally, and I love dogs, but I mean, he was literally posing with a puppy and talking about how much he loves puppies. And I was thinking to myself, this is Owen McClough does politics. Because it's got all that kind of, like, Simon Harris has one of the most wonderfully furrowed brows in all of sort of mankind. When he kind of like puts on his concerned face and literally has three perfect furrows across his brow. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, you couldn't draw it. And then
whole nods. Career would be over if he got Botox.
Yeah, exactly. And he nods and he says how concerned he is and he shakes his head and he promises his best efforts. And then he goes and he, you know, the other side of his character, which is the happy, smiley, you know, look at, you know, I love this program on the television. I love puppies. Isn't this a lovely jumper kind of character? That's what it is. That's the kind of package you're getting with him. It's Owen McClough as Taoiseach. And he's going to beat her on that. If she starts trying to play that kind of exchanging TikTok videos game, he's going to beat the snot out of her. With on that ground, I mean, where she is, I mean, whatever else you say about Mary Lou McDonald, and again, not a fan of her politics at all, and again, have met her in several times, and she's a lovely person in person. I want to say that, and I think it's very important to say that about people. She's genuinely a very nice person.
I love the way we're just giving out. It's Fiona, and it's this person's a nice person, and it's that person's a nice person, and so.
I never once said Fiona Sheehan was a nice person.
All right, okay.
I'm not saying he's not. I'm just saying when he comes to press conferences, he's not always nice.
But anyway, the point is we're really being nice today, except when it's really called for.
Well, I'm really being nice today, I think we should say. Yeah, it's not, look, I'm not trying to say in any way that I'm friends with these people, in case anyone thinks that's the angle here. I'm not. I've met both of them two or three times. But like you I do think it's important to make a difference between the person and the politics. But she's a person of political substance. She has ideas, she's policies, she can win a debate, but she can't out video Simon Harris on the TikTok front. She shouldn't try.
She used to be a person of political substance, and she hasn't been for a while. Neither has her party. They used to be the Party for Change. They used to be better. Something has happened. It's like sand going through fingers now for them. There is so much low-hanging fruit with Fine Gael at the moment. So many things that the public are incensed about. And she chooses that. She chooses to use her time and the electorate's, you know, the main party that the electorate have in opposition to the government. And she chooses to talk about what she talked about. And it's not just stupid. It's annoying.
Do you not think, in fairness to them, that it's not so much that they've changed so much as the ground has shifted beneath their feet? Because I think they have a good case to be the party of change on health, for example. I think they can legitimately say, we have a radically different approach on health. We would spend more money. We'd nationalize more things. We'd introduce a national health service. We'd do all this sort of stuff.
But John, the point of being in opposition, fine, okay, the ground has shifted beneath their feet. But the point of being in opposition is that you're not shouldering the burden of running the country. Therefore, you ought to have the agility to see politically, to see things coming over the hills in front of you, like immigration. And they didn't. And I think that's unforgivable. You're not running the country. So what have you been doing?
Yeah, well, it's more than that. Because, I mean, it's not as if they haven't identified the immigration issue. It's that they have. And Ben Scallon has done one video on this before, and he's another one coming, I think, on Thursday, which is yesterday, if you're listening, and today as we're recording. It's not been released yet as we're saying this, but it will have been by the time you're listening. Just basically going through their history on immigration. And he points out that this is a party that has been not just kind of pro-immigration in the sense that you and I are pro-immigration, Sarah. Like, you know, you and I are pro-immigration in the sense that we don't believe in you know, shutting the borders and never let anyone in. We believe that immigration, when managed properly, can be a positive and a benefit to the country. When managed properly, being the important caveat. Sinn Féin have a long record, going back 20 or 30 years, of actively being opposed to any restrictions on immigration of any kind. So it's not just that they didn't see the issue coming, it's that they were almost uniquely ill-suited to that issue when it arrived. And now they're trying to do this kind of dancing a jig around, pretending that they've always been skeptical of immigration, which is horseshit. Yeah. And you know, but it's not just on that. Where were they on crime? Where are they on crime? Forget immigration for a second. Where were they on, you know, the state of O'Connell Street, the general lawlessness in the country? What's their position on the trial that's going on at the moment of a Garda who is being prosecuted for dangerous driving after chasing? I have to be careful how I don't want to prejudice the trial, but it's a fact that he's being prosecuted for dangerous driving after pursuing three criminals who then drove the wrong way down the motorway and killed themselves. What's their position on that? Should that Garda be prosecuted? Is the law part? They don't have an answer to those questions. I mean, they're not in touch with those issues that really exercise people. So it's not just that. It's a whole range of things.
Well, I mean, I was saying to somebody, or a mutual friend, your deputy editor, Gary Kavanagh, the other day, you know, momentum in elections is, you know, very hard to achieve. You know, you like, it's hard to get, and it's what you want. But, you know, momentum in the opposite direction is very, very difficult to stop. And I think that's what's happening with Sinn Féin. I think that whatever Sinn Féin is on right now, like polling wise, they will do worse in the elections in 8 weeks than that number. I think it's slipping and slipping and slipping away. And I think it's a real, really big problem. And that video to me was a very clear demonstration that they either or both don't get it or don't have the capacity to stop it.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about who does potentially get it. And because, I mean, we mentioned briefly in the podcast last week, towards the end of the podcast, when maybe some people had stopped listening because we went over time. We mentioned a little bit about Pádraig Tobin and Aontú, who are continuing their modest but significant statistically rise in the opinion polls, where they're now kind of like in they're more in the 5 or 6% bracket than the 1 or 2 where they were. You've got Independent Ireland, who just announced Ciarán Mullooly as their candidate in Midlands Northwest for the European elections, where he'll be going up against Pádraig Tobin. You've got I'm tracking Adrian Cavanagh in Maynooth, who is identifying all these candidates who are running. If you go and look him up, Adrian Cavanagh, on social media, you'll find that he has a website where he lists all the candidates that have been declared by party in each electoral area. And I'm seeing a steady increase in candidates for AIM2, Independent Ireland. In fairness, the Irish Freedom Party are fairly well represented. They've got, I think they've got 16 or 20 candidates in place around the country. So like the alternatives for people are slowly starting to stack up. What's your sense of how they're each doing and whether they have a chance to make a breakthrough?
I think there's a huge chance here for a breakthrough. I think that in previous, particularly local and European elections, are quite unique in the sense that they're a combination of opportunities for the electorate to punish, to warn, you know, the government without major consequence, if you follow me. Mm-hmm. And I think that previously we've seen in the last local elections and local elections before, last local elections, were they particularly good for the Greens, as far as I remember?
There was a famous Green wave.
Yeah.
Which I think was a little bit overstated by the media as it was happening, but it was still significant.
Totally. I think that Hazel Schufer got the highest vote ever, or the highest vote in the country.
She got the highest vote in the country, and she got the second highest vote ever in a local election. I mentioned that only because it's worth saying that the highest vote ever in a local election still belongs to Leo Varadkar all the way back in 2004, when things were very different.
Well, Hazel Chu got the second, anyway, highest local election vote in the history of the country, which obviously is a clear demonstration that even the electorate make mistakes sometimes. But the previous general local election before that was big for Sinn Féin. So I think that, like, we're definitely on the precipice of something really interesting here. Like, you can't, if you're not in, you can't win. Independent Ireland have like 60 plus, I think, they're like maybe more, maybe 80 candidates nationally. And AIM2 have a lot. And I think that, John, as I've said to you offline before, like, I think when those boxes open and the votes pour out, you could see a really, really, really big sea change in independent AIM2 type candidates getting elected in a big way on that day.
Yeah, but I mean, this is a thing. I often say a piece I wrote during the week, but I write these things not so I can talk about them on the podcast, but because I think they're interesting. And I ask this. This is not. I get accused all the time of being kind of a desperate moderate who's opposed to like good patriots trying to change the country. But this is a serious question I want to ask you. How confident are we that a lot of those candidates know what they're getting into? Because I had one guy ring me up this week, which is why I wrote that piece, a really good bloke who was thinking about running for one of these groups and was asking my advice on not whether he should do it, but what would it take to do it. I mean, because he wanted to be serious about it. He said, if I run for election, I want to actually win. So how much money do I need? How many posters do I need? How much of a team do I need? You know, if I want to run a proper campaign. And my concern, I have to say, and maybe this is an unfounded concern, but my concern on behalf of some of these people who are running to try and change the country is that they don't have the answers to those questions. That some of them do think it's just a matter of sending a few tweets or posting it on Facebook and hoping that word of mouth will spread. And I don't think that's going to be enough.
I mean, obviously that's not enough. I mean, I think that there is a wave behind people that will make getting elected easier. But I don't think that it's all of it. You know, you definitely have to put in the work. You definitely have to get your name out there. You know, but like a rising tide of anti-government, anti, you know, the establishment votes will lift a lot of boats. You know, like, of course, there's going to be naive people who are running in the local and Europe, local, particularly the local elections. I mean, if they weren't naive, they wouldn't do it. because it's not, for the most part, like, let's call a spade a spade. Like, it's not a particularly enjoyable experience. And I know people will say, oh, you know, great day, like very welcoming doors and great day on the campus or whatever. But it's a grueling, tiring, hard thing to do.
It's soul destroying. Soul destroying, because people who do this, they get in and they think, I'm going to run, I'm going to go to the doors, I'm going to talk about my issues, which, you know, doesn't matter what they are. but I'm going to try. This is why I'm running. I'm running because I'm really concerned about X, Y, or Z. And you knock on the door and there'll be a tired mother standing there. And the first thing she'll say, she'll be with something you've no idea about. You'd have no idea it was even an issue. She'll say that you know, we've awful problems with dogs in the area off leads. What's your position on that? And some of these people will just never have thought about that issue before in their lives. And then they'll go to the next door and it'll be somebody who gives them abuse for something that they've nothing to do with. And then they'll go to the next door and it'll be somebody who goes, I'm not registered to vote. I might register. Yeah, give me your leaflet anyway. And it's a soul destroying experience. And on any canvas, even a candidate who is going to top the poll with 30% of the vote is going to, you know, go to 60% of the doors and encounter people who aren't voting for them. So it's all this. I had a great canvas stuff. It's always bullshit. Almost always bullshit.
Yeah, I mean, look, like there's people, the famous story of the woman from Sinn Féin, the last general election, got elected and she was on her holidays. Like there's people who are into it, who give it their all. And there's people who are just, you know, they're carried along by the wave, like I said. And I think there'll be a combination of both. Mm-hmm. But I think that for quite a long time, people like us and people that you would meet would lament, what's the alternative? What's the alternative? Well, this time there is one.
Well, I've been looking around. I was using the aforementioned Adrian Kavanagh's website, and I found that in my area, which is the Newport local electoral area, which is sort of mostly North Tipperary with a little teeny bit of Limerick and a little teeny bit, I think, of Offaly, but I could be wrong. I'm not an expert. And, you know, at the last election, I think there were like 4 seats and there were 6 candidates.
Yeah.
And I honest to God can't remember who I voted for. But like it was not an enthusiastic vote. I think I mainly voted because of the European election on. Whereas this time I looked around and I discovered actually that, you know, Independent Ireland have a candidate there and now I have someone to vote for. And by the way, if Ireland didn't have a candidate there and it was an A2 candidate, I would have someone to vote for.
Yeah.
But there is somebody to actually go and vote for now. And I don't know this guy. I have no idea who he is. I don't even know whether he'd be a good councillor. But I have an opportunity to express my views coherently through the ballot box on the issues that matter to me, which I didn't have in the last local elections. And
when RTE do their infographics on the news on the day of the evening of the count on the 6 o'clock news, there'll be a pie chart of percentage of people who voted against the government and your vote will now be in it.
Yes.
And that's nice. That's a good feeling.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that while that is my personal opinion, we obviously still at Grit Media try to cover the government fairly and objectively. But I think it's important that people know that when they're reading what I write, what my own views are. And my own views are that the country is in dire need of a change. That's my personal opinion, but it doesn't detract from my responsibility to be fair to people I write about. So there's that. So what else happened this week?
The CAST report has come out in the UK, which is, you know, confirming everything that people like me have been saying about, you know, ultimately the output of that report is that the recommendation is to never give puberty blocking drugs, you know, sometimes also could be referred to as castration drugs, to children. So, you know, words I thought I'd never have to actually say aloud, but turns out I do. And I think that the enlightenment is coming, that this has all been the 7 shades of madness, and that children are being damaged, like irreparably damaged by these kind of interventions in their young adult life. And hopefully it's the beginning of the end for that.
I don't know. I mean, I'm a bit pessimistic. I mean, I think that it's one of those things. Like I often say, like, the COVID years were so strange that we've kind of collectively, and when I say we, I don't mean everybody listening to this podcast or every individual, but I mean we as a society have kind of collectively agreed to kind of pretend that it never happened. And I have a feeling that on the CAST review and this whole kind of area, that ultimately, because it's so widespread, because the advocates for this included so many journalists, so many politicians, so many academics, so many of the great and good in society, just like lockdowns did, I think that the more likely explanation is that there will not be any great reckoning. There might be one or two people who are blamed in individual circumstances for making decisions. But in terms of the overall societal drift in this direction, I think it might be one of those where, as always happens when the left get it wrong, we just kind of quietly agree as a society to pretend that it never happened.
But I mean, that's still a better outcome, John, than continuing with this, because, you know, the continuation of this is more and more and more and more children, you know, being like indoctrinated into this cult. And I think that we're, you know, like, yes, of course, there's a part of me that wants reckoning for people who push this, and doctors and ghouls who are doing surgeries on children. But at the same time, at least it's stopping now, slowing down. It's not going to continue as if, like, you know, you're just so unkind if you don't agree with this. I mean, like, I was having a conversation with my dad about this a while ago, and we were reflecting on a few years ago of some of my wider family, and I had a massive row at a family dinner about this exact topic, when they accused me of being in favor of conversion therapy, because they said to me that if my child who was 8 or 9 came to me and said they were trans, what would I do? And I said, well, I'd first of all bring them to a therapist. And they're like, that's just conversion therapy. And I was like, so what do you suggest, that I bring them to a surgeon without ever getting them to speak to a professional? Like, this is absolute nonsense. And those people now are silent on this. There hasn't been a mention of Be Kind and trans rights in about 2 years. It's okay. I know they don't listen to the podcast. It's okay. I won't rub your nose in it that I was right. Because people just got caught up in this bullshit that, like, it was just so unkind to say anything and you just had to go along with it. Well, no.
Yeah, but
I don't need reckoning, but, like, at least it's coming to an end.
The most annoying trend in the so-called culture wars is an absolute refusal by one side to recognize the good intentions of the other. Because I am perfectly comfortable sitting here and saying that the overwhelming majority of people, including in your family/peer group you're just referring to, were indeed wrong, but were wrong from a place of good intentions. Like, the vast majority of people, I think, on relation to all this stuff about using pronouns, about respecting people's identity, and all the rest of it, are coming it from the basic perspective that we want to respect people's right to live the life they want to lead. And
of course.
And in their folly, they have taken that to a degree where they're now, some of them have become inured to the realities of what's happening. I mean, the cast review, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it made reference to the fact that puberty blockers in many cases cause testicular atrophy.
Yeah.
Which is to say that you put a young male on these things, then there is a significant risk that even if he comes off them at a later stage, enough damage will be done that he'll be childless for life. And you'll potentially have sexual dysfunction as well. So, like, you're playing with real parts of people's lives in the name of tolerance without fully understanding the science behind it.
But John, you're also being more gracious than I am, because the thing is that, like, yes, absolutely, that people who wanted to use the pronouns and wanted to be kind and wanted to be, were coming at it from a good place. But they were very militant in suggesting that people like you and I weren't coming from a good place.
That's the point I'm making. That is the single biggest problem with the culture war, is that one side, by and large, refuses to accept the bona fides of the other. So I'm no problem saying that somebody like Daniel Radcliffe, for example, who came out and said that he was in favor of all this stuff, was operating from a basic position of relatively low knowledge, but relatively good intentions.
Yeah.
However, people on the other side, take somebody like J.K. Rowling, who is operating from a position of having done a considerable amount of research and thinking about this, she's just a transphobe. That is the gulf. And in response, I think a lot of people on the sort of right, in inverted commas, now believe that that these people have forfeited any right to kindness or respect, and we should just treat them with the contempt they treat us. And that is what's causing these culture wars more than anything else. It's people refusing to accept that people with concerns about the direction of change are operating from a place of good intentions and bona fides. No, if you care about immigration, you must be a racist. If you care about transgenderism, you must be a transphobe. If you care about sex education in schools, you must be a homophobe. No. And that is the, if you were opposed to lockdowns, you must be pro-germ. Like, I mean, come on.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of it is stupid. But I'm not making that up. I said,
pro-germ just sounds like hilarious.
So So, yeah, I mean, on the cast review, I don't think we'll talk about it much more because I am, without giving anything away, relatively confident that we might get a guest of some heft, not J.K. Rowling, in case anyone gets too excited, to come on and discuss this issue with us next week. No, well, I don't want to. J.K. Rowling's reputation is bad enough, Sarah, without her having to associate with the likes of you and me. But no, somebody whose reputation might be able to survive talking to you and me might be on the program with us next week. So what else happened this week? I got in trouble with some people for writing that Donald Trump had changed his position on abortion, even though he has.
And why do you think that is?
Well, because in 2016 and 2020, Donald Trump ran on the platform that if he was elected president, he would enact a federal ban on what he called partial birth abortion, his late-term abortions. He said it was a disgrace. He said that these children are being born nearly alive and they were being taken out of the womb and killed. And he would enact a federal national ban on that. And now Donald Trump is saying that even though New York, California, a number of other U.S. states have legalized this, which is their constitutional right under Roe versus Wade, or the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe versus Wade, Donald Trump will no longer pursue any kind of national restriction on those kinds of abortions, because he now says it's purely a matter of up to the states. And to quote him, abortion rights are a matter of people doing what they want to do. Now, I understand there are people out there who got really annoyed at me because they say, look, Trump appointed the judges who did the Dobbs decision, which is the greatest pro-life advance in the last 30 years, and he's just trying to win the election. And what I'm saying to you is, that's fair enough, but he has moved substantially to the left on abortion. And he has changed his policies in order to try and win the election. And he has thrown your cause to some degree under the bus. Now, if you're fine with that, you're fine with that. But don't have go at me for pointing it out.
Yeah.
That's all I'm saying there. As it happens, I think on the politics of it in the short term, it's probably a good decision for him if it's just about winning the election. But my problem...
Do you think people don't see through that as garbage?
As somebody wrote this week, he needs 1%. If 1% of swing voters in some state decide that, you know, they can trust him on abortion, and not to enact national bans on abortion, and he gets those votes in a close election, it could make the difference. But I mean, my bigger concern is that he has now thrown every other pro-lifer in on the right under the bus in future elections, because now anyone who favors any kind of national restriction in the US on abortion for the rest of time will officially be more extreme than Donald Trump on abortion. And so this is what he tends to do. He tends to prioritize his own election over literally anything else. And I think a lot of people go along with that because they are of this view that Donald Trump is some kind of savior and getting him elected is more important than the future, more important than what happens to the party moving forward. So I recognize that people get annoyed sometimes. I also wrote a piece about Elon Musk and porn on Twitter that people reacted badly to because they thought I was attacking Elon Musk. But no, I just happen to think, Sarah, that it's probably bad when there are tens of millions of people using Twitter, a large number of them who are kids, who tweet something, and then underneath it, they get, as I got this week, literal porn. I mean, not kind of like one of those click through to read my OnlyFans things. This was literally...
What are they? I keep seeing them. What is that about? Are they bots?
They're bots, yeah. So they are automated accounts which are there to promote women who sell intimate pictures of themselves on a pay-per-view site called OnlyFans. And most of them, it should be said, are more in the... Most of those ones are more in the realm of the... I go back to the phrase, what's porn, you know it when you see it, right? But I, for me, most of those are more in the realm of the kind of risque than the pornographic. Yeah. But this week, I got, you know, literal. Like, it was to speak in terms that any children listening might not understand, but adults will. I got a picture of one very attractive woman performing cunnilingus on another, right under a post about, I think, economics. And if I'm getting that, then there are kids out there getting that. And some people will say, oh, well, it's just based on what you tweet. No, it's not. It absolutely isn't. These bots are targeting basically everybody who posts about anything. And I think Elon Musk should get a handle on it. And I don't think it's unreasonable to criticize people on your own side of the fence for not doing things that they should be doing. But some people thought it was.
Well, I mean, you're always critical about Donald Trump. Like, I mean, you're not a Donald Trump fan, so it's not like...
No, but I don't hide that. I think people, like, just as I say, I'm not a fan of the Irish government. I think people need to know where I'm coming from. That doesn't mean I won't try and be fair to Donald Trump. But like, I also think it's important to not have a blind spot about people on your own side. I mean, I would say, for example, about Pádraig Tobin, who I have the most immense respect for. And if there was an A2 candidate running in my area at this election, I would vote for them. There isn't for the moment. But I there are lots of things about Pádraig Tobin's political approach to the world that I wouldn't agree with, nor he with mine. And I think it's important to, not to turn politicians into, or even figures like Elon Musk into kind of messiah figures. And I think sometimes there's a tendency to do that.
Yeah, I mean, Donald Trump is like, I mean, neither of us are particular fans of Donald Trump, but I think that there's a...
It's fair to say you're more enthusiastic about him than I am. I think that's fair to say.
Am I? I mean, I don't know. Like, I found that really kind of grim and transparent and, you know, I mean, like not, but yet not surprising. I mean, I think Donald Trump is out for Donald Trump. He's never really been, in my mind, a real Republican. You know what I mean? He's not a party person. He doesn't care about the Republican Party. He doesn't care about the candidates. He only cares about himself and his career and his future. It's a pity him and Micheál Martin never met. I think they would have got on, actually. But I'm not a fan of his, but I kind of like what you're saying. Like, I think that he is good at some things, and I'm not consumed with hatred about Donald Trump so much that I can't have a conversation about him and acknowledge where he has or hasn't gotten things right at times. And I think a lot of Irish people are in that position, that they just hate him so much that if you say, oh, you know, Donald Trump increased more than any other president the and I think this is correct, I'll have to look it up, but he definitely increased the budget for sanitary products for women in women's prisons. Like, you can't even acknowledge that without some kind of negative, you know what I mean? Like, even a broken clock is right twice a day and all of that. And people are just so consumed with their hatred that they can't see past it. And I don't think that that's good for being able to talk about politics. So it's not that I love Donald Trump. I just think that my criticisms of him have more value if I'm able to acknowledge when he gets things right.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. I mean, I also think that he did tremendous work in a range of areas. I mean, he gets no credit at all for the Abraham Accords in the Middle East, where he basically secured something that most people thought was impossible, which was most of the Muslim states in the area recognizing Israel, which they still do even with all that's going on.
And when he was running as well, I remember distinctly the first time, you know, it was all poo-poo that he would ever get elected. And a lot of people, the narrative was, you know, there'll be a nuclear war. He'll blow up. How could he have the codes? Whatever. Least interventionist president ever.
It has to be said, this is really important to be said, which is that if he were president today, there would be people laying blame at his doorsteps for the situation in Gaza and the situation in Ukraine. And yet those same people will broadly excuse Joe Biden for any responsibility for them. Now, that is not to say that he should be blamed or that he shouldn't be blamed. It is just a statement of fact that on his watch, you've had two major conflicts break out. Yeah. And if you're going to say that the US president has a kind of global responsibility for, you know, geopolitics and maintaining the balance of power and preventing this sort of thing, then he's failed at that. And I think, actually, I'm being soft. I think he can take a lot of the blame. I think Vladimir Putin looked at Joe Biden and saw weakness and said, I'm going to chance my arm here because I don't think Biden wants a war. I think Hamas, and to indeed some extent Israel, both believe that they can sort of ignore Joe Biden a little bit without much consequence. I think Trump, because I think that there was the madman factor with Trump as president, right? There was always the sense that you weren't entirely sure if, when, or maybe he might like decide someday to wake up and press the button. So we better be careful with him. That just isn't there with Biden. And the madman factor is present. Ronald Reagan had it. I'm not saying Donald Trump is a madman, but I'm saying Ronald Reagan had that factor too. I mean, you were afraid, or some people around the world were afraid, that he could just wake up one morning, forget to take his tablets and push the button by accident. There are merits to Trump as president. But yeah, I'm not a fan in the round, I think it's fair to say. Anyway, we might leave it there for this week because we went over time last week, and we'll make up the balance next week when we maybe have more to talk about. But until then, unless Sarah, was there anything else?
No, I think that's it for now.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you listening to us as always. It's always a joy to read your comments most of the time. Most of the time, there are 10% of you, you know who you are, who just aren't nice people.
We're not mad at you. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, look, Sarah can't criticize anyone for mean comments after her performance earlier on in this podcast. So, you know,
I wasn't being mean. I was being honest.
That is true. That is true. You're being honest. I mean, for the record, I endorse everything she said. I just thought it was very funny. All right. Listen, until next week, from Sarah and from myself, that is another edition of The Week That Really Was. Enjoy your weekends, and we will see you here once again next Friday.